Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
God.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know. It was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it and send in a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to a special edition of Shoot the Defense. I'm your host, Del, and joining me is a gentleman who I like to call a friend. He's a development centre coach at QPR. It's Sogradis Haralambos. Sogradis, how are you doing, mate? You alright?
Hello, Stan. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Just for the benefit of our listeners, I think I'll call you Sok from now on because they'll probably be like, oh, it's these accents again, because I do it a lot on the podcast, you know? And I've had people saying to me, why don't you just call him Sokratis, not Baba Stathopoulos? And I'm like, because that's his name. that's how I go. Like, what do you want me to say? So yeah. Anyway. Well, look. Thank you for joining me. You're a local lad, kind of, aren't you? Because you live quite close to me. But we bumped into each other on LinkedIn, and I believe you had a spell at Omonia back in 2015. But let's go backwards, and we'll talk about your studies because you did a Bachelor of Science at the University of Nicosia. And that was sports and exercise, wasn't it? Was it just mostly sports, or was exercise a massive feature? Because I know a lot of university courses, they'll say business and IT, but there won't be as much IT as you expect it to be. So what was it like out there?
So basically, in Cyprus, I did a bachelor's degree of sports science. It covers all the aspects around the science of sports, not just football, like could be any other sport. I've decided to start studying this course in 2010, and I've, if I remember, 2011 September, I've started this course, and it goes about 4 years. The reason why I started this is because I felt that by doing this course, I could have deeper knowledge in regarding sports and science, and so that would help me to be a better coach in the future. Because the ultimate goal, let's say, was to be a football coach.
Right, so in Cyprus at the time, or even now, is it having this kind of educational, academic background important to be part of a coaching team? Because I've seen many coaches, you know, become head coaches in Cyprus, and I don't know what qualifications they've had. It just seems to me they've either been brought in because they're a name, or they know the owner of the club, or they've got a very, very good agent that can get them these roles.
So basically, I think it's a bit of everything. To be honest, the people with just the coaching certificate, and they can get the job because they have the network. Okay. They know someone. Sometimes that's how it works. Sometimes you might be too good. It doesn't matter if you have a bachelor degree or not. You might be very good as well. You might have the right mindset to get the job. And at the end of the day, your practice talks. So basically, what you do in the pitch, that's what's most important, not your CV. But having a bachelor degree, so having this academic background, especially if you've been a curious student, a student who was always who always loves to learn, I think that brings you something more into your practice, and you know you have a more holistic approach.
Understandably so. Now, for the benefit of our listeners, what would you say about the state of football in Cyprus at the time when you were there? Because on numerous occasions I've discussed my, my allegiance to Omonia, and I've name dropped a few times people like Matt Derbyshire, who I know at the club, and obviously Henning Berg is the head coach now, and the whole dynamic of the club has changed. But in terms of Cypriot football as a whole, when I was younger, and we're talking 20 odd years ago, if not more than that, you'd see a lot of foreign players going to Cyprus and they would kind of overwhelm the island. The whole place would be full of foreign footballers and you wouldn't see many Cypriot footballers develop as well as you'd like. So was the scope of Cypriot football very similar back when you were coaching or when you got that role at Omonia?
Full of foreigners?
Yeah, but also the ideology behind just bringing in foreign players, because it just seemed to be more like, oh, we've got this player because he's a name, yeah, as opposed to developing youngsters.
Yeah, I think all started further back, maybe 25 years ago, maybe more, depends. But the massive wave of foreign players in Cyprus was, I think, was after 2000, okay, and especially when the teams, our teams, had to compete in Europe, and also the regulations of FIFA and UEFA regarding foreign players changed, and you were allowed to have a higher number. I think that was before I even get into coaching.
Right. But as a fan, because you're an Omonia fan, right? So you've obviously seen the way that the clubs on the island have been active in the transfer market. And especially when it comes to coaches as well, because you've seen, you know, one coach maybe last 4 weeks before getting sacked out there. It's almost as if it's so cutthroat, whereby a manager isn't given time to progress. So in terms of someone such as yourself that wanted to become a coach, and you did your strength and conditioning experience at Omonia, I think you were there for a good few months. Now, in terms of the mentality to bringing in foreign coaches and foreign players, was the mentality the same when it came to recruiting people in the background, like, you know, physios, you know, strength and conditioning coaches such as yourself? Were they more focused on bringing in foreign people because they believed they had more experience than local people such as yourself?
I think they were not so interested in getting, you know, in building a team behind the team. That's what we call it now. I mean the coaching team, because usually it was a coach, an assistant coach, the strength and conditioning coach, the goalkeeping coach, and then they would have like one head of physio and just another physio or something, and a doctor. But now, if you go through the clubs now in Cyprus, I think at least the top, I can't really say because I'm not sure about that. I think the top six or maybe half of the teams of the league, they have a more they will have an analyst, they will have a strength and conditioning coach, and then they might have a rehabilitation coach. Some of them, they work with kinesiologists. I think even in 2010, it wasn't so, they wouldn't care so much. Even in 2015 again,
right,
just few clubs, they might had like two assistant coaches or just extra coaches who would focus on analyzing games.
Okay, so when you were doing your university course in Nicosia, in those 4 years, did you join any clubs to do your SNC training to help you with your coursework?
Yeah, so basically on my first or second year, I did my first attempt to, and I joined trials at Omonia Academy. Those trials, I had to just run a session, which I ended up just doing just one drill, and I failed. I didn't get the job, but I think I'm blessed, because then I found one of one of my mentors who influenced me and got me into coaching, who introduced me to a club which he was working that period as well. I think he's still there, and I might suggest you to interview him, but I know he's very busy, so okay. I don't know if that could happen. His name is Marios Christou.
Okay.
He was one of my lecturers, and I had another lecturer. His name is Efthymios Gyumurtsoglou.
Okay.
Efthymios, he's actually a very popular personality. He had the national Greek basketball team, and he had a Panathinaikos, PAOK. I think he had one of the best careers, and he might be one of the best Greek coaches of all the time.
Oh,
wow. Yeah. So I was influenced from both of them, and Marios got me into a private academy, which I started coaching, and that's when I started my career in, I think it was November 2013. And at the same time, I had to complete like a certain amount of hours of working experience, so I can give it like back as an assessment, submit an assessment to the university.
Okay.
And that's how I got to coaching.
Okay, fair enough. So how did you end up at Omonia then?
I think it was the last year of my studies, the fourth. In England, they have 3 years of bachelor degrees. In Cyprus, we do it 4 years. And I think we go with the American way. On my last year, we had to choose some of our subjects. So you had this opportunity to choose like a pathway within the course. And there was a subject called coaching internship, and I took the risk because I was aware of what's going on in England, where you get a chance to work in a club through an internship. And I asked them if I could get into a first team coaching team of any team in Cyprus. And Marios, we had a good relationship. He trusted me. He knew I was reliable. He knew I would attend and I won't miss a training session. And so he asked me, where would you like to go? Because he had linked with most of the top clubs. And when I say linked, I mean he knew mainly the strength and conditioning coaches of all the clubs, because they used to work together. He's an exercise physiologist. So he introduced me to, I straight away said Omonia, but we have to get the okay from Kostas Kayapas, the coach of Omonia, that period. So they accepted me, and that's how I got into an internship with the first team of Omonia in 2015. And that period, I honestly felt so blessed, because I was just 22 years old, being a member of a coaching team of a senior squad, and it was a unique experience.
Well, enjoy it.
We can talk about it if you want.
Well, you mentioned Gayafa. He's a club legend. I think he was playing for the club for close to two decades. You know, so
yeah, he's a club legend. In my opinion, he's a very good coach. I still remember a few of his methods, and back then I wouldn't have the perception to understand the way I understand now his methods, but as far as I remember, I actually liked his methods.
Look, and his dad's a club legend. I think he got the one the Golden Boot in 75, wasn't it? So did he? So he's a, yeah, he's a one ear is in their blood, you know. So
I was coaching his son as well.
Oh really? Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. So you how long were you there? 3-4 months?
February, March, April, and May. Four months,
right. And that season, if I remember correctly, where did they end up that season? Fourth? Fifth?
No, it was, could be third as well. Third. I think it was...
Because Baudet was the top goal scorer that season, wasn't he? He had a really good season.
Yeah.
So, look, again, it was a team full of international, foreign players, you know, you had people from Georgia, Spain, Portugal, Brazil.
Yeah.
How was it in the dressing room in terms of people communicating with each other? Because I presume English was probably the most common language being spoken, but I've seen on TV anyway, a lot of head coaches have translators with them these days, you know? So was it difficult to get the message across?
So basically the most important thing is that Kostas Kayafas was okay with English. I mean, he could get his point and make the players understand what he's talking about. And he was talking in English when he was to deliver a session because of the number of foreign players. Luckily, most of the players, they would understand English. Let's say the person I was reporting to, the head of strength and conditioning back then, was Paul Kina.
Okay.
Who's fluent in English. So, in general, the coaching team, they could communicate very well in English. So, they had a good communication, and I think the players, between them, they have this unity, they wouldn't argue, they wouldn't, I think... What I personally saw is players supporting each other, especially, and I could tell, like, from the way they treated the youngsters. It felt like a big family.
Yeah, well, that's very important for any club, really, not just a club like Omonia, any club in the world, because obviously the youngsters are the future. And if they're nurtured correctly, then you're going to be successful. So, let me get this straight. You spent some time at Omonia, and then you came to the UK where you studied at Liverpool Joe Moores University doing sports coaching. So,
master's degree,
Okay.
So, after I finished from Omonia, it was my graduation. And after my graduation, I took like a year of just... I kept working in the same private academy. For a year, and then the first 6 months before I leave Cyprus, I've spent them on finding a university in the UK so I can do my master's. And I did the whole process myself. I didn't go through any, you know, agencies or anything. And I chose the university in Liverpool, the Liverpool John Moores.
Yep.
I've applied. I had to do an English language test. I had to present my UEFA C license, which I did the same. I did in 2016 in the summer, and I think I'm not sure if I had to do anything else. Yeah, I just got the offer from the university. And the most important thing that made me want to apply for that specific course in that specific university is the close... they were working together with Everton.
Right, okay.
And Everton happens to be my club in England.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, okay.
Unfortunately, I had this interview with the academy. Unfortunately, I wasn't... was then chosen from the team, and because they only had four places and we were 20, and there were, obviously there were guys more qualified, more experienced, so they chose them. And yeah, I've, in 2016 September I moved to Liverpool, which I was doing my master's in sports coaching.
Wow, this is eerie for me, because in 2016-2017 season, Ronald Koeman was head coach of Everton, and his assistant was Fran Alonso, who's a friend of the show's. He's now coaching Celtic women. It's eerie how you mentioned that you're an Everton fan, you're in England doing your masters in Liverpool at the same time. A friend of ours was coaching at Everton. This is surreal. It really is surreal. But so in terms of what you learn, in the UK, what were the main differences to what you learned out here than in Cyprus? I presume it was more intense out here. Is that fair to say?
First and most important was the change in culture. Yeah,
right.
I had to come in a country with completely different culture. And talking about culture, we're going to go through that afterwards when we're going to talk about London. Because London feels like a different country.
Yes, thank you.
And Liverpool feels like a different country.
Thank you. Because this is what I've been trying to tell people. I've got a lot of friends in previous jobs. I've got former work colleagues who have said to me, "Oh, I want to come down to London." I'm like, listen, you don't know what to expect from London. Don't think it's all Buckingham Palace and Camden. London is a completely different world. Up north, it's nice. It's friendly. London is a different animal. But sorry, continue.
So I had to understand the culture of maybe Liverpool, maybe like university world of like being a student abroad. And so, it was a unique experience, because I had to live abroad for the first time in my life on my own. I was tight then with the money, so I had to be very careful. I made a great bunch of friends, international friends, like they coming from all around the world, and that was very nice. And I think the interaction with people with different cultures, if you're wise enough, I think you can catch something from that person and something from that culture. And you know, if you catch something good from everything and you add it to your life or your mindset or whatever it is, I think it makes you a better person. And I think it was during the university, at the beginning I was struggling to follow in the class, because it was my first, let's say, exposure in a completely English environment. Everyone was speaking in English and different accents. I had classmates from London, I had classmates from Ireland, I had classmates from Liverpool, I had classmates from Manchester, different accents. So when you go abroad and you speak you can speak the language, but then you get to hear different accents, it comes hard to understand.
Yeah,
and that was my first struggle, but I faced it. I think after 3 months I was very comfortable of listening to the lectures and participating. I think the difference with the master's and the bachelor's degree is that with the master's we had too much theory and then we had to study a lot on our own, where in Cyprus most of the time we were given the materials. We've been told what to do. Where in the masters, we've been more independent,
right.
And that comes to you, and you're fully responsible for your marks and what you do in the class, what's the outcome of your assessment, and then at the end of the day, what you learn from this experience.
Oh, absolutely, and learn you did. Because the thing is, when you see footballers come over here to the UK and they don't really perform well, a lot of people think it's because of the physicality and the intensity of the Premier League. And I'll always say it's very difficult to acclimatise to a brand new country, you know, as you mentioned, the culture. But there's other little things here and there. Now, I go on holiday to Cyprus, and I've got relatives obviously out there, and you know, they'll get up, they'll go to work, they'll come home, then they might go to a coffee shop, so they might go to the beach. Everything seems much more relaxed out there, whereas in the UK it's completely hustle and bustle. So for someone to come out here, you know, to learn a new language, to learn about the culture, to learn everything, they're basically starting from scratch. It's no surprise that a lot of footballers who have come over here from abroad have struggled.
Yeah, it's a different culture, and I'll tell you, I think one reason why the foreign players struggle in England. I've asked the university to help me and find a club which I could at least train. Coach, and they found me a local club in Liverpool, and I was coaching alongside the coach of the team, an under-16s, and that team was fully of English boys, like Northern English. Yeah, so they have this mentality, the tough mentality. They would get tackled and they would stand up. They like to play, they like the ball going up and down the pitch. There's no much technique into it, which at the beginning of the sessions and of the matches, I was struggling to understand why they can't simply put the ball down and play out of the bag, and it was hard to understand. I think that's one reason. It's completely different football. And I've played as well myself, a five-a-side in London. And I can tell that most of the people I play football with, the first thing we think is just to get the ball forward and just take a shot. It's not, they don't have a certain structure of, let's put the ball down, let's play first pass, let's draw opponents away. I don't say it's bad, because I don't think there's a wrong, right or wrong. But it's different. It's a different football. If you go in Spain, it's a different football. If you go in Italy, there's a different football. And that's what makes the players struggle when they come to England. If they failed to interpret and understand and the way the football is played in England, that's when we mainly talking about Championship and below, because in Premier League is different. We still see this this part of the English culture of football, but I think it's a more international culture in the Premier League. Because you have Brazilian players, Portuguese, Spanish, Italians, Africans. You have players from all around the world. So it changes the culture.
Yeah.
And now we can see City, Liverpool, the way they play, it doesn't have much difference from the way Barcelona or Real or PSG or Bayern would play. I mean, they have many similarities. And maybe they have more similarities with Bayern and Barcelona rather than Watford or Aston Villa. Just examples. I haven't done any analysis of them.
Okay, fair enough. Right, so let's talk about your return to Omonia. And obviously, again, this is the club that you supported You joined them in November...
Childhood.
Sorry?
From my childhood.
From your childhood, yeah, from day dot. And you're talking about 2017. Now, people that won't, that aren't Omonia fans or aren't fans of Cypriot football won't understand how pivotal 2017-2018 was, because it was probably one of the seasons that every fan wanted to forget. I mean, it was their 70th anniversary season. The club ended sixth. I think it was their worst finish since 1956. Three different managers. One of them was a Bulgarian manager who got sacked for slating the club on Bulgarian TV. The only shining light of that season was Matt Derbyshire getting 23 goals. But apart from that, it was poo. I mean, look, Jesper Fredberg, who we've had on the show, lovely guy. He had a bit of a spell there as a caretaker coach, and he was entrusted with changing things in the background in terms of the youth development. You joined as an assistant coach of the under-15s. So when you stepped foot in the club, had things changed from the time that you were there a couple of years prior to that?
Not really. Nothing actually changed a lot since then. Maybe the academy, the structure of the academy.
Mm.
During Jesper's time in Omonia, I think the academy was doing pretty well, and I think much better than previous years. And it was when I finished my master's degree, I made the mistake and I returned to Cyprus.
Wow.
And I stayed. I always say I should have stayed in the UK.
Yeah.
Because if I stayed in the UK, maybe now I would have been in a different position, but doesn't matter. I think I'm grateful for what I've been through, so I don't regret any decisions. But yeah, I returned and I stayed in Cyprus, and I decided that as long as I'm in Cyprus, because I've always had in my mind, back in my mind, that I wanted to do a PhD, and I wanted to do it abroad. Doesn't matter the country, I was open to go to any country, but I was open. So I had in my mind that any time I might leave Cyprus. So the easiest way to get into coaching was to do it voluntarily. So I approached Omonia and I spoke with Jesper. When I spoke with Jesper, I realized that Jesper is not just a random guy. I was actually impressed that we had such a professional in Cyprus. So he explained to me how the academy works. He explained to me what's the purpose of what was the goal of the academy, what was the plan. He suggested to me that he would prefer if I go to assist the under 15s, the 2003 born, which proved to be, I think, I haven't seen like such a bunch of players. At least 9 of them that were playing for the national team of Cyprus. The under 15s, I think, and the 14s. So, yeah, it was a great experience again. I had to attend... I was attending all the sessions every week, 5 sessions a week, and the game on Saturday. My role was to, most of the times, because of my background, I used to run the warm up, especially during the games. Sometimes I had to run some technical drills based on technique, and just mainly assisting during the session, mentoring the players, monitoring the players. Sometimes I had to monitor players during rehab, We had sessions in the gym. We had strength and conditioning sessions on the field. So it was experience of a bit of everything. I met with a kinesiologist, so I learned about this area as well, and the importance of having a kinesiologist in your club. It wasn't an easy season. The team finished undefeated. They won the league. It was one of the best batch of players you can find in Cyprus. Because now two of them, as far as I know, they play in Germany in under 19s or 17s.
Frankfurt, isn't it? Is it Antonio Foddy?
Yeah,
under 17s, Frankfurt. Yeah. He's got Bulgarian background, hasn't he, or something like that?
Antonio,
yeah.
His brother Christian as well played for the first team once, or a couple of times, sorry, under when Jesper was as an interim coach.
Okay.
One of them is Loizu, you know him, yeah?
Yeah, he's left with now, he's got to be 17, 18 now? 17. Well, you've seen the likes of Gagulis breakthrough, Loizu. Blimey, this is what I wanted to get at, because when you look at the players that have come through, you know, Karalambos and Gagulis and Loizu, as you mentioned, the infrastructure is there, and you've got someone like Henning Berg who's willing to give youth a chance. And then you still look at the youngsters that are still at the club, you know, under 21 levels, like Yagos Banayi, that's got a very bright future. And even the goalkeeper, Nicolau, 19 years old, they're all being given these opportunities. So it tells me that perhaps the mentality is changing in Cyprus, because while, yes, it's great to see a lot of these foreign players come in, and, you know, we've seen the likes of Lesiaks do really well, Vita Gomez, etc., Omonia especially, I think it's Rayo, who's at Anorthosis, he had a fantastic season. They're still bloody youngsters, the club, which I guess has always been part of Omonia's philosophy, really.
Yeah. There are many reasons why they've had to came in that position now where they have to produce players. But one of the reasons is that the Cyprus Football Association has a plan. Many clubs follow that plan, not 100%. One of the main problems we had, and we still have, and I think the Cyprus Football Association, especially the coach educators, they're trying to develop better coaches, because if we have good youth coaches, then we have better youths. And I think the players you mentioned, they've been players who've played for the club since Jesper, and maybe some of them before Jesper, but I think those players and many other players from other clubs, I agree that the talent is there. You can tell there's a talent there. The problem now is, do they give them the opportunities to develop? And I think at the moment, as I can see, Omonia gave opportunity to some young players, which is encouraging for the other young players. And it's not just only Omonia. I think I've seen a couple of young players in Cyprus now. And the best way to see the talent of Cyprus is just have a look at the youth national teams from the under 19s, under 17s, 16s, 15s. There is a talent. And it's usually free of charge. You can go on YouTube and watch the games. They play, they could play with any other national team. And you can tell there's something going on. I mean, it's not like the, I don't know, the previous 10 years, which it was,
Yeah, it's been a topsy-turvy in the doldrums. I know. I feel your pain. Now, put it this way. Right now, things have changed at the club, as you know. A lot of fans believe it's not for the best. I believe that, you know, the way that Baba Stavros come in and he's changed the mechanics of the club. You know, Andreas Dimitriou has done really well from a PR perspective. Tell me what you feel about the club, because you're one of the Gate 9 supporters, aren't you? Whereby you're not happy with the takeover of the club for your own reasons, obviously. It reminds me of AFC Wimbledon a little bit and FC United of Manchester. I think more FC United of Manchester, where the Glazers took over Man United and then a lot of fans were very disgruntled. They went and created their own club, which is what the Gate 9 Ultras have done. They've created Omonia in 1948. What are your thoughts on what's happening at the club at the moment, and why have you, I wouldn't say stop following the club, but change your allegiances, so to speak?
So basically, in terms of football, talking about football, like, you know, the sport and the performance and the team, and in my opinion, they have been doing a great job this season. There's a good coach, there's a very good coaching team. Things look to run professionally, which I like to be fair, and I don't like to, even if I disagree with something, I have to admit that if something is working the right way, I have to say it. I mean, it doesn't mean if I disagree with what happened to the politics of the club and the way they changed. If I disagree with that, doesn't mean I have to disagree the way the club runs and the performance of the team.
Yeah.
So this is something different. As for the, let's say, the politics of the club, the change of the status of the club. So before, it used to be like a public club,
yeah.
It's a public club which belongs to the public. It doesn't belongs to anyone, to any owner.
Kind of like Barcelona, right?
And FC Bayern. They're the main examples of a public club. The difference and why there's a group of supporters who reacted and they decided to leave and create another club. The main idea behind this is why and how Omonia established. And what's the politics behind it? And it used to be people's club. It used to be, let's say, left-wing club. And it wasn't just the status of the club would change. It's the way it happened.
Right.
That was the main. That was the main problem. That those supporters had.
So, explain to our listeners what your thoughts are on this, because I know the club was in 13 million euros in debt at the time. So the people that were running the club at the time weren't really doing a great job, were they, from a financial perspective? And obviously on the pitch, it reflected their issues.
Yeah. So basically, there was a lot of, you know, talks. Everyone was talking. Everyone was saying that that club doesn't have a structure. Everyone has a say in the transfers. Everyone has a hand in the transfer and stuff. So it sounds like a chaos, you know?
Mm.
Chaos. So usually healthy report affects the state of a board affects the team always. Mm. If there's a problem in the board, there's usually a problem with the, and that has to do could be money, could be anything. Why I disagree with the way they did it, it was because, let's say you're Omonia, yeah? And your name is a brand name. If you think you're actually the biggest club of the island in terms of, not trophies, because Abuel now is the biggest in terms of trophies, but you're the most popular club of the island. You have fans in the UK. You have fans in Greece. You had, even in Bulgaria, you had fans.
Yeah.
So why you didn't go in public and announce that we making the club, we offering the club for businessmen. So, and with this way to kind of make businessmen to create like a business plan and come and present it to you and create like a competition between them and make them willing to buy the club and offer to the club. So that's one point. The other point is that when they presented the plan of Papastavrou, I personally, and many people as well, we didn't believe that reflects to the value of the club in financially mainly, because the money he promised to put in the club didn't reflect on the value of the club and what the fans could bring into the club, what the name of the club, the brand of the club could bring in terms of sponsors. Because he's a big name, it's not just a local supermarket. He's a big name.
Of course. Yeah. But do you think the fans were maybe a little bit too quick to judge? Because I remember, I think it was around about 2015, Gate 9, they put out a statement and they accused Agel, which was the left-wing party, or is the left-wing party, of holding the club to ransom and basically driving them into financial debt. Do you think the politics have kind of got too much influence on the club over the years?
I think nobody can hide the reality is that politicians were in the club and in the board of the club, and or at least people who are much involved with politics, they were much involved with the club as well. I mean, they were members of a specific political party, and I'll give you another example. People were applying to become members of the club, and they wouldn't get accepted unless, and that was an assumption that many people made, unless they know you and unless they know you support, let's say, the political party. Now, right. This is a big statement, and when you don't have facts to back it, you have nothing, actually. They will tell you you're lying.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that I personally, I have applied as well. Right. And for 3 years, I wasn't accepted.
Is that because you've been...
I never got accepted.
Hang on, is that recently you've applied? Is that since Papastavrou took over? or just
no, no,
before?
I've applied in 2014 I'm not sure when was it. I think it was 2014.
Yeah, so it's not as if like you've been blacklisted by the club or anything. Perhaps you were just unfortunate, or maybe it was a fact of not what you know, who you know, the person that got the role instead of you was probably linked with someone inside the club. But just quickly going back to my original question, which I kind of deviated, so it's my fault. But do you feel that when you look at this season so far and the way that the club has evolved, you know, obviously they haven't officially been given the title, but you know they've been deemed as the top club. They reached the semi-finals of the cup. Obviously, Derbyshire's had a fantastic season. Both the Akers come, he's been fantastic. The back four, granted, they had their issues, but again, Hubachan's done well, etc., etc. I can reel off a list of names, and Berg's first season has been fantastic. Do you think a lot of these Gate 9 supporters have been a little bit hasty in making their decision? Because let's be real. I mean, I understand what you're saying about how Baba Stavrou's his remit or what he said about how much he's going to plough into the club doesn't meet your valuation, so to speak. But perhaps it's going to be a gradual process whereby if they win the league one season, they'll win it again and dominate, kind of like how Aboah have, and then reach Champions League, get that money, and he will spend that money wisely or as he should.
You mean if they would spend the money wisely?
Yeah. Because I don't think he's a businessman. Let's be 100% honest. It's like he's like the Glazers. He's like John Henry. He's like Stan Kroenke. They're all businessmen. So obviously they're here to make money. But I don't think they're gonna run their business into the ground. He sees Omonia. I honestly believe he sees Omonia as a cash cow. Let's be real. But he can also make them a successful force. That's what I believe. Because if they dominate the Cypriot League much as, say, Celtic have dominated SPL, they'll constantly get Champions League football. The money will come in and then they can strengthen and build on that. Wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah, no. I think that's their plan. That's actually their plan. And they've realised that before last season started, I mean this season, the one that finished now, because they hired, in my opinion, they hired people who know the league. They had a highly recommendation. I think that's their plan, and they said about it. They said that they would like to go to Champions League. They would like to make money from Champions League and invest those money, and I think that's their plan.
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand the Gate 9's perspective in the sense that, you know, they believe that the club is no longer for the people, because as you said before, it was fan owned, and you know, but at the same time, the way I see it, I think that, you know, this Baba Stavrou's come in and he's obviously been successful. He's pumped money into the club. He's trusted the manager. He's done things the right way, in my opinion. So I can't see any reason to be unhappy with the new ownership. Granted, I'm talking short term now, because the here and now, this is what we're talking about. We don't know where the club's going to be in 4 or 5 years' time. We don't know if the value of the club is going to be raised and someone else is going to come in and see how well the club is doing, and they'll get bought out by, I don't know, an Arab or a Chinaman. I don't know. You just don't know what's around the corner. But I think right now is the tide is turning. That's what I honestly believe. I think the tide is turning in Cyprus. I think that Upwell's stranglehold on the title has gone. I think they had four managers this season. They had Ingebrigtsen, they had Thomas Doll, I think they've had four in total this season. You know, okay, Anorthosi, they're doing well under Getspire, but again, they fell off back into the season. When it came to the playoffs, they were crumbling. Apollon have changed their manager. They've got a Swede in charge now, so we don't know what's going to happen there. Then you've got Ayak and Ael, who are, they're a bit iffy. So really and truly, Omonia are really the club that can take the baton and move with it. They've got the Champions League qualifiers coming as well, so if they can make the group stage, that'd be great. So I think the future looks bright, but at the same time, I can see where you as a fan is coming from, because I'm a Man United fan, and I've seen the way that the club has kind of regressed since the Glazers took over. Granted, people say United have won Champions Leagues under Sir Alex Ferguson, but that was because of Ferguson. It wasn't because of the Glazers, you know? And we've seen with Moyes, with Van Gaal, with Mourinho, these three guys, they couldn't work their magic at the club. So right now, Omoni's in a similar situation, but I think they're on the right path. But at the same time, I do sympathise with you, and I do empathise as well.
I'll give you two examples why I agree with you. Not 100% in terms of the bright future. I'll tell you why. The club increased the debts, but the company that runs the football department decreased the debt.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
So the club doesn't have any high income now, as it used to be before the club becomes a private company, before the football department becomes a football. Yeah. And the rest of the department, the basketball, volleyball, futsal, I don't know, I'm not sure about if any other departments. So them, they were alive because they were supporting one another, and the supporters were going and supporting every department, and they were giving money to save every department. But now, if you see the agreement for giving the football department to a private company, is how much money is she paying the club to hold the football department?
Mm.
And how much money the club makes from the football department now? So if I think they released the stats, I don't know, a month ago or 2 months ago, and the debt of the club is increased.
Right.
But the debt of the football department, I think, is decreased. I'm not sure about that.
I mean, it makes sense given the amount of players that they've brought in, I guess, signing on fees, agents' fees, and all that kind of stuff. But I honestly believe that a lot is riding on qualifying for the group stages of the Champions League, because we know how much money is involved. If you're talking about, you know, £2.5 million for a win, or €2.5 million for a win, and almost €1 million for a draw,
it could be 30 million.
Yeah, so 30 million, and that effectively wipes off all the debt, and they've got pocket money, or cigarette money, or girl money.
I tell you what, are they gonna give money to the club? Because that wasn't part of the agreement.
Yeah, well,
that's one thing that you have to consider.
See, this is it. Yeah, this is it. We don't know. Don't know this. So, but the thing is, again, I think it's normal to be very skeptical of a businessman and how he wants to treat the club. I could talk about Mike Ashley and the way that he's absolutely pillaged Newcastle United. And yeah, he's pumped a little bit of money into them this summer. They brought in Joelinton and they brought in Almiron the previous summer. But all in all, he's just using the club to fund all his other business ventures. And do you think that's maybe what Baba Stavra was trying to do? Is that what you think, or what the fans think?
Could be. I can't really tell because there's not much we know about him.
Mm.
All we know is that he runs a business in the US, which is, I think, lending money.
Yeah.
They are skeptical because imagine if that's not part of the agreement and the club don't have any other sources that bring money to the club.
Mm.
And Baba Stavra is not willing to give money to the club, or he's willing to lend money to the club. In what state he's gonna lend the money, and what is he gonna demand to lend the money? That's what people are skeptical.
But the thing is, when you look at the bigger picture, sorry to interrupt there, but when you look at the bigger picture, I mean, I know they've. Was it they're upgrading the training centre in Yeri? I think that's been approved by the town's authorities, and I think they're going to spend about £2 million on that, or €2 million. I keep saying pounds, it's euros, isn't it? €2 million. And I think they're planning on building a new stadium to move away from the Gazi B, which is something I think they need to do, because I think aren't some teams in Limassol are going to be sharing a new stadium soon?
Yeah. Well, this is part of their plans. As I said before, I don't doubt about their intentions of making the team great again and achieving things. I don't doubt about that. It all has to do with how the club is given to just that specific person. Which it was actually just to one specific person, and with the way it was given, that was their whole argument. And let's talk about the new club the fund created.
Yep.
And I'm just gonna give you, I'm not gonna go deep into that, I'm just gonna give you an example of what they've been talking about. Yeah.
Yep.
They now exist 2 years now. Yeah. The that club is 2 years old now. They already own a training ground. How did they got that training ground? Is that training ground, as far as I know, just it only cost nearly £100,000 in pounds, not euros, right? That's the amount. And now they're spending more money to rebuild the training ground and make it. You know, they're basically trying to make it the way they want to have some stands, to have new changing rooms. They have to do changes because it's not a new stadium. It's quite old and it needs to rebuild.
They're not using the Magario, are they?
No. They only used it for a couple of games.
Okay.
The whole point of this is just they're trying to show you that things can work when you don't have interest, and when your purpose is not just to make money, it's just to, you know, because they do this with passion. Mm. Yeah. And they showed you that within 2 years they won two promotions. Now they own a training ground, and maybe in 2 years' time they will own their own home. Like as a, they already have offices. They already have a shop. I mean, this is just in 2 years' time, and United of Manchester as well is quite similar story. They own their own football stadium. They have the training ground. They have offices, shop. Yeah. And I think they just showed you that things can work with this way as well.
Mm. Yeah, the only thing is, and I won't say too much, but FC United, they've got their own financial problems. A lot of people arguing about money in and around the club.
Okay. And yeah, so, I wasn't aware of this.
Yeah, see, this is it. AFC Wimbledon have got financial problems. They're practically... Well, again, I'm just speculating from what I've been told anyway. So they're financially ruined. But see, this is it. It's about mismanagement. And that's the problem that Omoni had in the first place, which led to Baba Stavro taking over. Yeah. The mismanagement, people... Listen, we've seen it so many times with different clubs. So many football clubs over the years have been so successful, and then they end up out of business. Look at Bury. Bury, one of the founding members of football, you know, and they don't exist anymore. So... We've got to be very careful, you know. You know what they say, be careful what you wish for. almost as if you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, I don't want the club to be owned by a businessman, but then I want it to be run by the fans, and then all of a sudden it gets run into the ground because too many people or the wrong people get involved in the club, and they become greedy. So I think it's very dangerous. But you know, at the same time, it's very exciting. I think because right now, you know, I'm on in 1948... They've, as you mentioned, they've got their own club shop. They've got their own website. You can see the history of the club, and you can find out why it's so important to support this club and the allegiance. And I think it's very exciting because, again, while it's been done before elsewhere, it's a new project for the fans, and it is for the fans. Let's be real. I mean, people go to the bars, they go to, you know, to see their team, they, you know, they meet up before the game, they have their souvlés, you know, they all that kind of stuff. It's the community feel of it. And I think when a club is taken over by a wealthy businessman, be it Man United, be it whichever club it is in the world, you kind of lose the soul a little bit because it becomes too commercial. And I think that's why a lot of clubs these days, they're trying to get that back. The only club I could really think of right now off the top of my head with that community spirit is Ajax. Ajax have still got it, you know. Ajax have got everything from top to bottom. They've still got that feel there, you know, that spirit. You know, you turn up and outside the stadium. I've been there a few times. Outside the stadium.
Yeah, I've been once.
Yeah. So you've probably seen it outside the stadium. I can't remember which stand it is, but they've got like a little pitch for like kids. And it's a tiny, tiny little pitch that's drawn on the ground. You know, so it's like you and I when we were kids, we were playing football in the streets. We put our jackets down and we use them as goalposts. Or we use a telephone pole as a goalpost, that kind of thing. And again, it goes down to the grassroots of football, the root of it. And effectively, without fans, there's no football. Wow, that was a monologue and a half, wasn't it? Bloody hell. Well, look, one more thing before we wrap it up, Philemon, because I know that I've taken up over an hour of your time. Talk about your time at QPR, because you've been there for quite a while now, no?
Yeah. So, let's just go quickly, if you want. I came back to London to the UK in London in 2018. No, it was November. And I'm still struggling to get a full-time job in football. It's not easy. You feel blessed if you have such a job. And again, it works with who do you know, how good you are. It's not just your CV. It's what do you do in the pitch. It's a whole of process to understand and get into these kind of jobs. And again, in London, I was trying to understand the culture is completely different than Liverpool. Different nationalities, is like multicultural, and you have to understand where everyone is coming from. I had to understand how Sunday leagues work. I had to understand like parents' point of view. The kids are different. They're not like in Cyprus, in my opinion. So basically how I got into QPR is last year I've applied to do the UEFA-B course. And I was thinking to do it with the Scottish FA.
Yeah.
Or the, I think it was the Irish FA.
Okay.
But the English FA and the Welsh FA, they wanted me to do my C license again.
All right.
The Irish FA never replied to me. I think it was the Northern Irish. And the Scottish FA said to me, apply in December 2019, and in February 2020, you will know if you get accepted.
Yeah.
Then I said to myself, why waiting, and why waiting for other people to decide my, decide my fate or my future? So I rang in Cyprus and I spoke with the coach educator of the Cyprus football coaching school. And we had a chat and he said to me, come and do it in Cyprus, it's different, it's a better level. I decided to do it in Cyprus. So I did it in Cyprus. I went to Cyprus in September 2019 for a week, October 2019 for another week, and my exams in January 2020. And I got my UEFA-B license in February 2020, right before the lockdown.
Okay.
Our coach educator knew a member of the staff of the QPR Academy.
Yep.
He visited a lot of academies in England, and that's how he met him, I think. He also visited St. James Park, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
He had a tour within the facilities to understand how England works in football development, so he could then go back to Cyprus start planning again, you know, like changing things for the plan. It was a great experience living the, doing the UFRB license. And I said to him, how I'm going to complete my assessments living in England. He said to me, I will introduce you to a friend of mine and see if you can go there and start coaching and get into coaching. So he gave me the number and the email of that person who works in the QPR, and it happens that person will to be the head of academy recruitment. So I rang him up, we had a chat, and he explained to me how things work. He said to me, you're going to have to come all the way to West London. So basically, I live in North London, in Enfield, and the training ground is near Heathrow.
Wow, yeah, yeah. So it's the college, isn't it? Is it the college ground?
Yeah, it's a college ground. It actually belongs to belongs to Imperial College.
That's right, that's
but
right.
I think now QPR bought it.
Oh, they have? Okay. I think because the last time...
they announced it, I think I saw it yesterday on LinkedIn.
Right, okay, because it's quite recent. Because I went down there a couple of years ago to interview Chris Ramsey, and it was Manisha Taylor that put me in touch with him, so I still got to thank her for that. I have thanked her, but I thank her.
I know both of them, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, they were good people, both of them. You know, Manisha's done so
all
well.
Of
and,
all of them in the academy.
So I went down there, and I was quite surprised, because I was like... This is a college. It's not. What is this?
So basically, I met the people there. The person I'm talking about is Gary Kasser.
Okay.
Gary is a lovely person. Whoever needs help, Gary is there to help, guide you, tell you what you have to do, where to look. So Gary got me into coaching, so I started coaching with the development center. Once they gave me uniform, we met each other well, like after 2 months or something. I asked them if I could participate with the academies, any groups of the academy. Just to, I had to shadow the coach. It was part of my UFRB assessment. I had to shadow the coach and taking notes of the training session. That was part of the assessment. They showed me my choices. So I didn't have too many choices. So I chose to shadow the under-18s coach.
Okay.
If you know him, it's Paul Furlong.
Paul Furlong, he used to play for QPR and Chelsea, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul is a lovely person. He's a lovely person. He welcomed me from the first minute, and he was, he was very positive. He said to me, feel free to step anywhere, ask me questions. So I was, and the rest of the coaching team as well, his assistant coach Micah, the head of sports science Ross, sports scientist as well, I think Ben, I think the whole coaching team was lovely, and it was a great experience. And I was with the team for a month and a half, shadowing the team, and sometimes I had to participate as well, help the boys with some drills and stuff. It was a great experience. I would never forget it.
I can imagine. Well, yeah. So Gradin, well, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Hopefully we'll do this again sometime soon, because we do the late fitness test podcast we do with Ben Dinnery and Johnny Wilson, who's the clinical director at 108 Harley Street. Maybe you can jump on the show with us and we can talk about injuries and return to play and all that kind of stuff. And maybe even one day, when I eventually get round to it, we can do an Omonia podcast, even though this was more Omonia related, to be fair.
Excellent.
Well, before I let you go, do you have any social media that you want to plug, like Instagram or Twitter, anything like that?
Mainly is my LinkedIn. I don't use my Instagram for professional and my Facebook. I don't use them a lot for professional. I haven't been a lot of a social media person.
It's
mainly my LinkedIn because I know it's more professional and that's where I approach people or people approach me. So they can find me. It's Socrates, S-O-C-R-A-T-I-S, Haralambous, C-H-A-R-A-L-A-M-B-O-U-S, and that's how they can find me, or they can go and find you and find me after finding you.
there you go. And I'll put it on my LinkedIn, I'll put it on my Twitter, my Instagram, because I plug every show on my socials, so yeah. Wonderful.
I'll put it on my social media anyway.
Bomba, lovely.
Yeah.
Right, we're on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We have a Instagram, sorry, I was about to say LinkedIn. I have a LinkedIn, but I'm not going to give you that because you don't want it. But we're on Instagram at Shoot the Defence. So until next time, ladies and gentlemen, take care.